Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. What's a Zoom room? It's what your conference room is meant to be. With flawless video and audio conferencing, instant wireless content sharing from any device, and just one tap of a button to start a meeting. Any space can easily become a modern, simple-to-use Zoom room. From tiny huddle rooms to executive offices to huge training rooms. And Zoom Rooms is effortlessly scalable, from a few rooms to a few thousand. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial of Zoom Rooms and meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 28th of March, these are the main stories. President Trump has signed a $2 trillion relief bill to support the American economy through the coronavirus, the largest such intervention in U.S. history.
I want to thank Republicans and Democrats for coming together, setting aside their differences and putting America first.
The International Monetary Fund says the pandemic has plunged the global economy into recession, which will be at least as bad as the financial crisis of more than a decade ago. And more than 900 people with the coronavirus have died in Italy in a single day, the most for any country. The United States Congress has passed a $2 trillion bill to support the country's economy as it copes with the effects of the coronavirus. It's the largest emergency aid package in U.S. history. Millions of Americans have lost their jobs and businesses are struggling to cope. According to data from the Reuters news agency, nearly one in four U.S. workers say they've been laid off because of the pandemic. Earlier, President Trump signed the bill, which contains measures to help workers, small businesses and industries.
I want to thank Republicans and Democrats for coming together, setting aside their differences and putting America first. This legislation provides for direct payments to individuals and unprecedented support to small businesses. We're going to keep our small businesses strong and our big businesses strong. And that's keeping our country strong and our jobs strong.
The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, praised the bipartisan effort.
This is a very special day for us. I think it sends a very clear message to the American people, to America's families gathered in their homes, all of the healthcare workers working to bring solace, minister to the needs of people who need their help, to the families who've lost a loved one. We are all a family, and like many families, we have our differences, but we also know what is important to us.
So will the historic deal help save the world's largest economy? I spoke to our Washington correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher.
It certainly is historic. It's half the size of the entire $4 trillion budget of the government. And a lot of people will get the money. So there'll be direct cash payments to Americans, to millions of Americans, for $1,200. It will offer tens of billion dollars to bolster the healthcare system, to bolster states and local governments, and hundreds of billions for companies that are hard hit. Now, that's big and small, but there will also be, in particular, a program with guaranteed subsidized loans worth about $500 billion to go to larger industries and corporations, and it will substantially extend unemployment insurance.
And this from a right-wing president, no fan of government handouts.
Well, yes, but a president who likes to go big, the biggest, remember? As he was signing the bill, he said, "I've never signed anything with a T on it," and you could see he was really enjoying that. And according to reports that we were hearing, he wanted Congress to go big because for him, this is really about politics in a presidential election year. He's based his re-election platform on a robust economy, and the economy is tanking. So now he's positioned himself as a wartime president who will preside over the rescue of the country. And for that, he needs to go big. That's what's happening.
The Reuters news agency is saying that one in four American workers have been laid off. We're talking about tens of millions of people. That could impact his re-election prospects, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I think that's what he's thinking about. I think the next months up until November are very uncertain, and it will depend on how President Trump handles this, what the experience of Americans are, and how much they would blame the president for their problems, or whether they believe that he has stepped forward and is doing everything he can. And I think that this package is part of that. But, you know, Congress has rallied also almost an unprecedented way, certainly in recent years, in a bipartisan show of unity to rush this package through. So it's also the response of Congress, of both Democrats and Republicans.
And very briefly, the president has used federal powers to force General Motors to switch production.
Yes, finally, he has said he's going to force a company to produce ventilators. He's been saying up until now he doesn't need to, that private companies are stepping forward, despite much pressure from governors who say they really need these ventilators. He claims General Motors made a promise that it didn't fulfill, so he's invoking these powers. But again, it's a sort of wartime president act.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington. The United States is fast fulfilling the prediction from the World Health Organization that it could become the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. It now has more confirmed cases than any other country, more than 85,000 positive tests. But the number of deaths remains relatively low for the time being, at just over 1,300. David Blumenthal was National Coordinator for Health and Technology under President Obama. He told the BBC that the US health system was not well suited to cope with a national pandemic.
We have a disorganized, fragmented, decentralized healthcare system without a trusted central authority. The one time when we usually do defer to central authority is in the time of national emergency. But we have not seen the kind of leadership here that one would need to have had to stop this epidemic in its tracks.
Julian Marshall spoke to the U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar and first got his assessment of the outbreak in the United States.
Well, it's obviously quite serious. I'm particularly concerned about the New York City metropolitan area. Over 50% of our existing diagnosed cases and over 50% of our new cases are actually in the New York metropolitan area, actually clustered in four counties there. But we do have cases around the country, largely a result of travel. And we're working very aggressively to try to get the New York situation in particular mitigated. We call it delaying and flattening the curve. Can we delay the larger impact throughout different parts of the country? And can we flatten the impact of that so that we don't overstress the healthcare capacity in any particular part of our country at any one time? So we're taking it extremely seriously, as I know all countries are, but working to delay and flatten the impact of it for our people.
And how does the federal government intend to flatten the curve?
So right now we're nearing the end of President Trump's 15 days to slow the spread initiative. You see, we've got a federal system here in the United States. We, at the national level, make recommendations. We provide advice and expertise and some surge capacity, but primarily it's our local governments that actually have the plenary police powers for public health protection. So it's locally led. It's state managed and then federally supported. So President Trump has laid out expert guidance from our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for individuals, for the workplace, for the schools, and for communities around social distancing, telehealth, telework, teleeducation, keeping 6 feet from each other. These are some of the same steps that China's taken, and I know the UK is taking and others are taking to try to slow the spread of the disease. The name of the game in public health is, can you get the R-naught below one? That the R-naught is how many people does an infected person transmit to, and if you can get that below one, you're going to be on the downward slope of infections in your country.
You're doubtless aware, sir, that New York City in the first instance is crying out for personal protective equipment for its health workers and also ventilators. What is the federal government doing about that?
So in terms of personal protective equipment, we have been sending out millions and millions of supplies of what are called N95 respirators. Those are the higher end masks for hospital workers. We've also opened up the supply of those in the United States by most of the of those types of masks are used for mining and construction trades, and we've approved their use in the hospital setting. We've also made surgical masks. Those are the gauze masks that one simply wears over the face, faster and easier to produce. We've made those available for more hospital uses based on data. And we've worked with our clothing manufacturers. One company, Hanes, a famous clothing manufacturer, has actually designed and secured the Food and Drug Administration's approval for a reusable mask, a washable, reusable cloth mask. In terms of ventilators, there actually is excess ventilator capacity currently in New York City. And so we'll keep working with New York, but on average, 1C is about 3% of your positive COVID-19 cases going into the intensive care unit, and about half of those, 1.5%, might need to be on a ventilator at any one point in time. So we've sent 4,400 ventilators to New York. That alone would be a capacity to support over 146,000 people being infected at any one time. But we're going to be there for New York, and we're going to be there to support them as much as possible, even as we scale up production of personal protective equipment and ventilators, as frankly, every developed country around the world is doing.
Alex Azar, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. The International Monetary Fund says it's clear that the global economy has entered a recession that will be at least as bad as the downturn sparked by the financial crisis 12 years ago. The IMF's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said more than 80 countries had made requests for emergency funding as a result of the pandemic. She was speaking at a virtual news briefing in Washington.
A key concern about a long-lasting impact of the sudden stop of the world economy is the risk of a wave of bankruptcies and layoffs that not only can undermine the recovery, but can erode the fabric of our societies.
Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The economy, as she put it, has been brought to a standstill because large swathes of economic activity simply aren't happening. However, she said also that although the cause of this steep downturn was the lack of activity linked to containment efforts to control the coronavirus, she said those efforts were absolutely necessary if we want to be able to continue with our way of life, and that therefore the question now was to take this action, this containment action, and prepare for recovery in 2021. And she said that in order to do that, the IMF would be drawing on its entire $1 trillion lending capability. She also said that there would be a doubling of emergency funding for countries that requested it. She said that 81 countries had so far come forward with requests or inquiries about emergency funding, and normally the IMF would be dealing with just a handful. So she said there's been a real surge, and that what the organisation is focused on is particularly poorer countries which are struggling and are finding that large amounts of capital are being taken out of those countries at the moment, giving them potential problems in the future. So she said, yes, a coordinated action is needed, more action is needed, and that the IMF, along with the World Bank and other multilateral organisations, stands ready to do it.
Theo Leggett. The World Health Organization has warned that the chronic global shortage of personal protective equipment is one of the biggest obstacles to preventing deaths from COVID-19. The WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said 2 million items of protective gear had been sent to more than 70 countries, but more was needed.
This problem can only be solved with international cooperation and international solidarity. When health workers are at risk, we're all at risk.
Mr. Tedros said he had urged the G20 countries to use their industrial might and innovation to produce and distribute the tools needed to save lives. Now to Italy, and the country that has recorded more than 900 coronavirus deaths in a single day, pushing the country's fatalities to more than 9,000. Infections, though, continue to fall. Julian Marshall heard more from the BBC's Mark Lowen in Rome about these latest figures.
It is more than 200 higher than the previous one-day rise, so a very, very difficult figure for Italians to take in. Just in Lombardy, in the northern region of Italy, the worst hit by the virus, 540 people have died there in the last 24 hours. In terms of the infection rates, well, there is a chink of light there because it is slowing and the curve is flattening. But the progress in over 2 weeks of this national lockdown now is slow and uneven, and the awful news just keeps on coming. 46 doctors have now died in Italy since the outbreak began.
You said that 541 of those deaths were in Lombardy. What's the geographical spread of the others, do you know?
Quite a lot in the other northern region, Piemonte, which is suffering, and then south of that, Emilia-Romagna, where around Bologna is high, Veneto around Venice is high. But also the worry now, Julian, is that the cases and deaths are rising also in the south, in Campania, around Naples, and in Lazio, around Rome, from where I'm speaking to you. And the fear there is that southern regions of Italy are much poorer and less developed than the north. I mean, the Lombardy health system is one of the best in the world, and the hospitals there are struggling to cope. There are no more intensive care beds available in Lombardy. They're all taken by coronavirus patients. So if the hospitals in Lombardy are struggling to cope, just imagine what would happen if the southern regions or even down in Sicily were swamped with cases. So there is a desperate need to reach this peak to flatten the curve, but the Italian National Health Institute has now said that the peak has not yet been reached and that the restrictions here will have to be extended beyond the 3rd of April.
Mark Lowen in Rome. Now, as we heard in the earlier podcast, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that he will continue to lead the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis, despite contracting the disease himself. In a video on Twitter, Mr. Johnson said he was suffering mild symptoms and was isolating himself. Britain's health secretary also has the virus, and the chief medical officer is showing symptoms. Generally, in the UK at the moment, it is not easy to get an immediate test for the coronavirus. Our reporter Siobhan Leahy, however, has been tested at a drive-through centre.
So it's Friday morning. I'm in the car with my housemate en route to a temporarily closed theme park just outside of London. We're getting tested for COVID-19 because this week we've both had symptoms and my housemate is a paramedic. And to make sure she and the rest of her colleagues are back on the road safely, we're both eligible for testing. So we're on our way now and we'll let you know when we get there and what happens. We've been directed to a queue of cars in a large car park and we've been told our car windows must be kept up and we're not allowed to leave the vehicle at any point. So we're just waiting in line now for the testing and they shall come to the car windows and do it. I have blown my nose, yeah.
Okay, any cuts or and inside the mouth, any cuts? In? No. Mm-mm. Okay, ulcers, no ulcers. Mm-mm. And no bleeding disorders that you're aware of. Mm-mm. Okay, so it's going to be a bit uncomfortable. You're going to go in the mouth first and then the nose, okay? Nice and wide and say ah.
Ah.
Good. Okay, you can roll your window up.
Thank you very much. Okay, so that's it. We're done. The medical professionals took swabs at the back of our throat and the top of our nose passages. It was quite uncomfortable, but I'm glad it's done now. We should be waiting about 3 days for the results, and this will tell me whether I have it currently, not whether I've ever had the virus. So now we go back into London and play the waiting game.
And we wish Siobhan Leahy well. The government in South Africa says it will strengthen the role of the army in patrolling a nationwide lockdown which came into force on Thursday night. There's been a patchy response to the strict rules about staying indoors and the country has reported its first two virus-related deaths. On Friday, our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding saw how the lockdown was working in Johannesburg.
Go to your houses, say the police. But with mixed results in South Africa today. Tear gas and arrests this morning in central Johannesburg and frustration from those trying to do the right thing on day one of the lockdown.
There are people that are not taking this thing seriously and this thing kills. Why are so many people around here? Because they were supposed to be in their houses.
Does this feel like people are just getting used to the rules or do you think people are just not going to pay attention?
I think they're not going to pay attention.
The police and army have been trying, along with everything else, to enforce a ban on the sale of alcohol and cigarettes.
Thank you. Can I see your ID?
But the more pressing issue here is surely crowd control. And there was no sign of social distancing at this bus stop. Commuters more concerned about getting home.
Are you worried about standing close to people?
No, no, not really.
Do you think you should be?
Yes, I should be, yes. But what can you say? We need to be in queues. We need to get home.
These are early days for a boisterous nation, but the government is anxious to get this right and soon. Infections are expected to rise significantly in the coming days. Plenty of people here are obeying the new rules, but there are already mutterings that it might take a state of emergency to make this lockdown really work.
Andrew Harding in South Africa. Also in the podcast,
My name is Dina Martins. I'm a co-owner of the Portuguese Love Affair.
We hear how one restaurant in London that has been closed because of the coronavirus pandemic is helping the local community. $1.5 billion children are now missing school because of measures taken to slow the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to the UN's education agency, UNESCO, which says that 87% of the world's student population has been affected by the closure of universities and schools. In Switzerland, families are now in their second week of school closures. Our correspondent Imogen Folks met some of the families who have turned their living rooms into classrooms.
In an apartment in the Swiss capital Bern, a little girl of 8 is doing her music homework.
School prepared it very well. They made a timetable for each topic where she can pick out some work she likes to do.
Although Mother Naomi is pleased with the way the homeschooling has been organised, she's still coming to terms with the change.
When it started in Wuhan, it was far. And when it came to Italy, it was still far. And when it came to Switzerland, it was still far. And now it's in the neighbourhood.
Right across Switzerland, every hour on the hour, the radio reminds the population to stay at home. Just outside Geneva, Tom is supervising his 3 children as they do their lessons online.
Everybody's knocking around the house. We have to sort of make sure that everybody gets a break and gets to go out the door. But frankly, it hasn't been bad at all. The big worry is obviously the Easter holidays and, you know, potentially other holidays.
Mesdames, Messieurs, bonsoir. Une mesure spectaculaire concerne la fermeture des écoles.
The school's closure was announced on a Friday afternoon. By early the following week, teachers were ready with lesson packs for each child. The teachers are available in school hours for phone or online consultation.
So, yes, in Mirna!
Swiss TV is broadcasting educational programmes. Still, Dagmar Rössler, president of the Swiss Teachers Association, knows this will be a challenging time for parents.
The teachers have to provide education for all the children, but of course parents are not sure what they should do with their children at home for the next weeks.
Many parents admit they are still coming to terms with the sudden change to work and family life. As Tom points out, it is huge and disruptive.
It feels a little bit like 9/11, you know, that shock feeling that the world has changed. But this time it's really personal and it's affecting every household. I haven't heard anybody talking about when this is going to end. So we're just trying to keep calm.
And as time goes on, the stresses start to show. Not just the schools are closed, but parks as well. Gatherings of more than 5 are forbidden. Parents like Naomi are worried about the effect on their children.
We go in, we stay at home, and it is difficult because I can't let her going out and play. For her, it's really difficult.
Imogen Folks in Switzerland. Around 3 billion of us are now living under quarantine because of the coronavirus, and authorities across the world have very different approaches on how to police these new measures. I asked our reporter Charlotte Gallagher if some countries were using more force than others.
They certainly are, Joe. So we've seen in India, police officers actually beating people with batons who are breaking quarantine and they're out of their house when they shouldn't be. We've also seen videos of them making people do squats and press-ups by the side of the road to encourage people not to leave their homes. We've also seen in Rwanda, 2 young men, they were shot and killed because they were out of their house when they weren't supposed to be. Peru and Saudi Arabia, just 2 of the countries that are threatening to jail people for years if they come out during lockdown. Some very worrying photos we've seen from Guatemala and El Salvador. People who were breaking the lockdown were being rounded up in groups and being put into trucks obviously hundreds of people together. We're meant to be social distancing, but police officers and these people all grouped together, that is incredibly worrying. The city of Menden in Western Germany thinks it's got a good idea, though. So what they've done is they've got an old gym, they've cleared all the equipment out, they put in loads of camp beds, and they're saying to people, if you break these rules and you're out of your house when you're not supposed to be, you will have to live in these gyms, and it's pretty basic conditions. And Sebastian Alt is the first alderman of the city.
I don't want to scare anyone, but the issue of deterrent is a very important issue. Yes, such a gym that's fitted out like that shows quite plainly what happens to the people who don't obey the rules. We mustn't forget that none of us has ever experienced a situation like this.
Now, Charlotte, we've seen countries using mobile data to track people's movements. Tell me more about that.
Yes, and it's raising some questions about privacy. And obviously, this is an incredibly serious, life-threatening situation in lots of countries, but people are still concerned about how their data is being shared. So Singapore and South Korea, they've both been using mobile phone data and credit card information to track coronavirus in their countries. Israel has actually gone a lot further. They approved emergency measures, essentially bypassing parliament, which means everyone's mobile phone can be tracked. So they're trying to track people they think have coronavirus and making sure that they are staying inside their homes. They'll also be able to text people that they think might have come into contact with an infected person, essentially warning them. And there's a lot of concern in Israel because this is usually only used for counter-terrorism operations. It's never been used for public health measures. But this is the time that we're living in at the moment. And a lot of people are uneasy in South Korea and Singapore too, about how this information is going to be used and how long these measures will be staying in place. China as well, lots more CCTV there, CCTV outside apartment doors, making sure people aren't leaving if they need to be quarantined.
My colleague Charlotte Gallagher there. We've been asking you to tell us how you're keeping your spirits up during the family isolation, and this one is special. Here is the Costello family in South Bend in Indiana performing along with Monty Python and Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Don't grumble, give your whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
That's Tim Costello and family. Thank you. Let us know how you guys are getting on. Our email is globalpodcast, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. The Royal Mint, usually known for making coins, bullion and gifts, is to begin the mass manufacturing of protective visors for the National Health Service in the UK next week. Engineers at the site in South Wales were able to come up with a design and get it approved in just 48 hours. Rebecca Drought reports.
Just 3 weeks ago, the Royal Mint announced the release of a new coin to commemorate the 25th James Bond film. Today, staff there are attempting to come to the rescue themselves by helping to ease the shortage of personal protective equipment for NHS staff treating those with COVID-19. The Director of Operations at the Royal Mint, Leighton John, said the fact his sister worked for the health service had focused his mind on the problems hospital staff were facing. He set engineers the challenge of developing medical equipment that could easily be made on site. Just 7 hours later, they'd created a protective medical visor or clear plastic face shield using rudimentary designs they found on the internet. Within 48 hours, it was approved for mass production. The first batch is already in use at the Royal Glamorgan Hospital. At the Mint, they're gearing up to start making large numbers and are appealing for a source of clear plastic. They also plan to post the specifications for their design on their website so other companies can make the visors too.
Rebecca Drought. And finally, as we know, many businesses around the world have had to shut up shop during the coronavirus crisis, but some are still doing their bit for their communities. Dina and Olga are a Portuguese couple in East London who've closed their family restaurant, but they're still cooking to provide locals with a hot meal, despite not profiting from doing so. They are the owners of the Portuguese Love Affair restaurant, and they spoke to Victoria Craig.
My name is Dina Martins. I'm a co-owner of the Portuguese Love Affair.
Our idea was really just to focus on people that might not be able to come out, despite the fact they are infected or not, to help them out with very little things, including a warm meal. It feels good also to be able to do, in a moment like this, something for our neighbours. And I think we need to keep positive and help each other. That's all this is all about.
How'd you get the idea?
The idea comes with humanity. As a Portuguese, with lots of Spanish and Italian friends, it's already happening there, and we know for a fact that we need to help each other and we need to stand together.
Are you fixing a certain meal every day, or is it kind of made to order, or how are you deciding what to do?
We're planning to do this maybe just one or twice a week, depending what the government is allowing us or not. Some people, they can order food to collect. We also, with some other friends, working out a scheme to deliver within the neighborhoods too.
Are you making any money off of this? Because obviously your restaurant is now closed.
Really, our worry right now is to keep everyone safe and fed. And that's it. The money we'll see later with our landlord.
Are you worried about how long you might have to stay closed because of government restrictions? And what does that mean for your business?
Well, as a small business, is obviously a big worry because, you know, East London rents are not that cheap. And we might have to stay, I don't know, a month, 2 months being positive here. You know, I also have employees and I worry for them. I worry for myself. But, you know, I've started so many times, so I'm pretty sure we can restart again with more energy and more love.
The restaurant owners Dina and Olga in East London. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.
Introducing Pocket Casts, the powerful podcasting platform recognized by Wired Magazine as the podcast app every iPhone user needs and by the New York Times as the favorite among podcast experts. Pocket Casts is beautifully designed, easy to use, and helps you quickly discover and enjoy your favorite podcasts with over 700,000 shows to choose from. Download the app, now free, at pocketcast.com.